the subject for the evening talk is in the form of a question. And the question is, do I believe in God? There are two areas of the world, probably a lot more, but certainly two areas of the world which have become known for the depth and determination of religious exploration and religious experience. One, of course, is in this area of the Middle East, and there are many records of people who have made tremendous efforts and determinations to explore and discover and be touched by what we might call the religious experience. And that has been chronicled and recorded in various texts through the centuries. And the other area, equally well known, where the same tremendous determination took place, is in the long strip of land between the foothills of the Himalayas and the River Ganges. And in that area of northern India, spiritual and religious exploration of experiences took place, continues to do so. It's the land of the Buddha, of Krishna, of Mahavira, a land where people remove themselves from the norms of daily life of varying lengths and periods and went in search. The old Buddhist texts record the dialogues that took place. The old Hindu texts, the Upanishads, chronicle the accounts which took place of meetings with teachers, the dialogues, the inquiry, the question and answers, the insights, the revelations, the realizations. And for some, whether of the East or of the West, there has come about a certain, shall we call it, formulation of language. And for some, the language of G-O-D is easy, comfortable. A person can refer to and speak of God without any misgivings and discomfort or anguish. Others, when asking oneself, do I believe in God, as the theme and question of this talk this evening, will say, I don't know. I'm not sure. What do you mean by the word God? And others will respond to the question, do I believe in God, and say, no. The word has no meaning, no relevance, no significance. I can't relate to it. And in some languages of the world, in some Buddhist countries, there is no word for God. It's not a reference point. Yet, whether there is a relationship to God or whether there is no interest in G-O-D, still the pursuit and the exploration of spiritual or religious experience continues to take place. There are still cave dwellers. There are still people who go to the desert. There are still people who go to the jungle, go to the hermitage, go to the monastery, go and remove, short or long term, oneself from the normal conventions of day-to-day life for the exploration of something else, something other. And one of the features of that exploration, which does at times need to be addressed, of course, is religion the religion of our birth, a religion not of our birth, of any practical use for us? How is our relationship to the religion that we have been born in? how is our relationship to a religion that we haven't been born in and have been exposed to? Does it contribute, or is it a problem? In looking at ourselves and this concept of God, the immediate response may not matter too much. We may say yes with some affirmation and positivity. We may say no with the same affirmation and positivity. Or we may say, I don't know. How will we find out? When the concept itself arises in our mind, if it ever does, what kind of responses do we have just to the concept? When you and I meet people who are committed theists, committed believers, what's our response to their form of language? When we meet with somebody who's a committed agnostic or a committed atheist, what's our response? So in our relationship to life and our experience of life, we can be extremely secular or extremely religious in our beliefs, but surely it's the quality of our life which really matters. The quality of our life. Sometimes we meet with people of any religion anywhere on this earth, north, south, east or west, who have tremendous certainty, who can quote with great frequency from a particular religious text or a guru or a master or a tradition or whatever. And we feel the pressure from that person or from that group. And everything that that person says might be true, might be accurate, might be from their experience or from their understanding of what they have read in a particular religious book. But something else is happening as well, and it makes us feel uncomfortable. We feel an aggression. We feel a tone of voice of self-righteousness. We feel a moralizing, a preaching, an arrogance going on. The words of God and love and other religious language is coming over. It might be important and valuable, but something else is being communicated at the same time in the tone, in the manner, and one says, how is it that in the depth of being, the tone, the deeper things can matter more to us than the language, than the words? Radha Krishna was the former president of India, wrote lovely commentary on the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna's dialogue with Arjuna in the chariot before a battle. Maybe a battle, inner battle of conflict and confusion, inner war as much as anything else. Some Radha Krishna lived in Madras, in South India. It's the place where the British colonialists started their ugly venturism into India. And one day, it's about 40 years ago, some missionaries knocked on his door. He invited them in, Christian missionaries in this case, and said, come, sit down and we'll talk. And they spoke of Jesus and how Jesus had come into their life, and spoke of love and God and the New Testament, etc., etc. But the tone was very aggressive, that kind of missionary zeal, and began to accuse him of being a Hindu, a tool of the devil, and all of that. Radha Krishna turned to them and said in one line, what can Jesus do for me what he surely hasn't done for you? Rather a blunt, cutting, direct statement. In other words, the words can be right. God is love. There's much which is revealed in the Testaments. Much love and compassion to be found in them, but something else carries over. That something else matters more than the words. And we forget this. We forget it again and again and again. And we get caught up in the language, in this case, religious language, or political language, or economic language, or secular language, or philosophical language, or spiritual language. We are mesmerized by language. And we want to touch something deeper than language. Sometimes in religious life, we form a single view about it, for or against, comfortable or uncomfortable. And sometimes one meets in the religious life other aspects of that element of tone in life. And sometimes people, sometimes monks and nuns and priests and rabbis and mullahs, sometimes a kind of serious, rather contracted tone showing itself in the body. Rather, life is heavy, life is suffering. Oh, the problems of life. And the whole body tends to contract and be rather insular in its viewpoint. Just as you and I can be when we are caught up around something, quite fixed about something and quite insular in the view. And so in our relationship to life, as I said, how is the inner life? One aspect of religious life, if it's truly religious, is that one is touched with joy in life. Religious life must embrace and must include joy and joyfulness and spaciousness. I remember, to give you an example, sometimes in religion there are these rather, I think, rather depressed looking people, rather contracted and serious and gaunt and never look at you. And it's a common phenomena all over the world. But there are plenty of other people in religious life. Different kind of relationship to it altogether. And also with good spirit and with joy and with humour. And I remember a Muslim telling me a rather sweet story. Long time ago, the mullah, the priest in Damascus, every day would go to the minaret, called, isn't it? The tall tower, and call everybody in Damascus, this is centuries ago, to prayer. But one day, he had a terribly sore throat. No loudspeakers in those days, couldn't shout. And then he thought of the one person in Damascus who had a really good voice. And that was the local Jewish rabbi. So he went to see the rabbi and he said, "Look, can you help me out?" He said, "I can hardly speak. I want to call my Muslim brothers, sisters to prayer. Would you go and do it for me?" And in the calling of prayer, Daniel here wrote it down because I can't remember it. La ilaha illa Allah, Muhammad Rasulullah Allah. That's his name. Would you go and to the rabbi, go and do this? So the rabbi, went, and there is only in the Muslim tradition there is one God. His name is Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. So the rabbi went, climbed up all the steps in the minaret, got to the top, ready to call and call out with his tenor voice. The Buddhists would probably say it was Pavarotti in his last life or something. And instead of calling out that, he called out, "There is only one God. His name is Elohim, and his word is the Torah." And this came out all over Damascus from the minaret. The Muslims looked at each other, the Jews looked at each other, all started laughing and enjoyed the humor of the situation and said, well, we're all of one tradition, why not? Can you imagine that today? Can you just imagine a rabbi? Gosh. So in the relationship to the spirit of things, this is a Muslim joke, by the way. In the relationship to the spirit of things, how the feeling life is, the emotional life is, the responsive to life is, that is what matters. And as I say, sometimes the sense of God matters for people. And so many times over the years, people on retreats and out of retreats have said to me, Christopher, I had this experience and it's really affected me. It really has touched me. And the spiritual tradition has detailed, if I may say, with great accuracy in the Buddhist tradition, tremendous precision, unusually clear precision, the vast range and the place and the relationship of religious experiences or spiritual experiences or unfamiliar experiences. But it's also said to us that different aspects of life can trigger them off. For some, it can be the simple gesture of the bird on the wing, traveling through the air, leaving no trail. And it touches us in a way which we can see millions of birds and yet. Sometimes in listening to teachings, we are touched in that moment and something awakens us and our eyes are opened. Or through reading, but not that reading in that monstrous way that we are taught in schools and universities, which in my view ought to be closed down and we start again to give people a genuine deep education into life. But that kind of reading where it's meditative and contemplative, sometimes in spiritual religious texts, sometimes in the novel, very often to be found in certain kinds of poetry, and it touches us. But it's not a reading for knowledge and information and all that distraction. It's a reading for something deep in the being. It can come to us quite spontaneously in the middle of a crowded bus, in the desert, in the cave, in the jungle, in the monastery, sitting on the meditation cushion or whatever. And it would appear from the long tradition of religious or spiritual experiences that they have a significant influence on one's life. Some of you in this room will know and will be able to recall particular moments in your life which were genuine turning points. One went from one value system, perhaps, to another. One pattern of life. And the world was shaken up for oneself and one began to look, reflect, dwell, organize, in fact, one's life. Because in some way one was touched. And sometimes it happens through just a brief interaction in no special circumstances and one's been changed by it. We put it in the language of religious or spiritual. When one looks at oneself and asks oneself, here, during these days of our retreat together, has one had such an experience? Has one been deeply touched by life and has it had an ongoing influence? And some may say, yes. Yes, I see the influence of that. I see the impact of that in my life. And some will say, I have no idea what you're talking about. What you've just said in the last 3 or 4 minutes, I can't relate to. And so if one says, well, I've not been touched deeply about this thing of living, then I think one ought to be asking oneself, why haven't I? Is it just chance? Is it just karma? Is it just I got missed out? And sometimes people have said to themselves very significantly, what am I prepared to do, to sacrifice, to feel the deep embrace and the deep touch of life? What am I prepared to do to make myself available? And the long tradition of this area, as well as other areas of the world, should be a reminder to us of keeping the heart and mind open for something profound in life. Yesterday evening I was speaking with some friends in my room, and coincidentally one of the people who I was who is here is a very good friend of mine. Name's Paula Green. She's on the Buddhist Peace Fellowship in the United States. She's an activist, and she's been here in Israel for a conference on the International Fellowship of Reconciliation. It's a peace network. And recently, in December, she was at Auschwitz. And there with a number of people from various parts of the world. And the Buddhist group organized at that time a walk, which is still taking place, from Auschwitz all the way through to Japan to Hiroshima. There were about 80 people at Auschwitz to show the terrible suffering, the uncivilized, barbaric suffering that has gone on this earth, in this so-called civilized world. And Paula was there helping to launch and get underway this long walk. Some people doing short distances, others doing long distances, and certainly there are several friends of mine who are participating in that walk. And she mentioned to us that four of the monks, during the middle of the bitterly cold winter, sat for 8 days at the end of the railway track in meditation, and just took some liquid in the middle of this 8-day period and walked around one of the most horrible places I would imagine on this earth, and walked around beating their drum and just stating something in non-conceptual terms about life and death and respect for life and the significance of it. And from that, they began their walk. And I use it as an example of something deep in the human being where we can't find words to express things. And a sitting expresses something. The beating of the drum expresses something about humanity and life and waking up. So we're now looking at our life and the everyday fact of our life and the existence of it. There has been a consistent message to us about realizing something vast and profound. You and I, as I say, may not be comfortable with the language. We may not be comfortable with the religion. We may not be comfortable with tradition. We may not be comfortable with saints and sages and rabbis and Zen masters, etc., etc. And that's our right not to be comfortable with any of that. But it would be a pity for us to say, well, I'm not comfortable with any of that. Therefore, I don't want to explore that which is vast. It would be a pity. And sometimes, as you and I know, religion has turned billions of people off. And thus consumerism becomes the religion, the supermarket becomes the synagogue, and money becomes the means to heaven. The religion that we live in, the predominant religion that we live in. So see, spirit and life and joy and happiness are important features. But when you've just sat for a day and for the first time, for some of you, you think, what on earth has watching my breath got to do with deep experiences, finding of truth, realizing of God, understanding what the saints and the prophets and the sages have said? Christopher, my mind is all over the shop. I can't even find my nose to know if I've got the breath to get there. And you're talking about these things, about going to the desert. I'm in the desert already. My mind is a desert of nothing, etc., etc. So sometimes, as I say, we come into these situations, and it can be for us, look, I'm not really interested in these deep things of life. I'd be quite happy for a little relaxation, a little less stress in my life, a little bit less pressure, being able to speak to my mother and father without shouting at them, to feel a little bit more comfortable when the weather is hot and I'm sweating. And sometimes I say, oh, that would be enough for my life. But honestly, not a chance. It never will be. Something moves, what the mystics sometimes call inside of oneself divine discontent. We can have it all. We can have our lives so beautifully organized. We can have the triple gem of the Western society, which is a good job, a good car, and good neighbors. We can have it all sorted out comfortably. Divine discontent will still keep moving inside. It has to. Something else calls us. Something else. I had another story. I told a story a few minutes ago of the rabbi and the mullah. I had a lovely story from a Christian. There's some lovely stories. Where there's good humour in religion, it gets my vote every time. And in Jerusalem, Christian story. In Jerusalem, got nothing much to do with the talk, I just wanted to tell you the story. In Jerusalem, a man ran a shop, as he had done from his generation, a Christian man, for many generations. And he sold many household items in the shop. One of which, what he sold, was nails. Everybody understand in the Hebrew, nails, the hammer, nails. So he put an advertisement in the local, probably Jewish Post or whatever, newspaper, and showed the crucifixion. Jesus, you know, nailed to the cross. And the advertisement underneath said, "Our nails have been used for 2,000 years. I think Jesus would love this. If Jesus was here, he'd love this story. The next day, a Christian came to the man in the shop and said, "Look, I don't think it's a very good advertisement to put out, because it gives the idea that you sold the nails." He said, "Oh, all right, because I didn't think of that." The next day, there's a new advertisement. And it's Jesus again, hanging on the cross, but one hand is hanging down. And underneath it said, "This would never have happened if they had used our nails." The next day, man came to the shop, "Look, you really shouldn't have just..." People get upset by this. Your Christian brothers and sisters at church, they won't like this. Next day, there's just a picture of the cross. As you know, the Christians believe that Jesus was resurrected from the cross. Under it was, "If the Romans had used our nails, he still would have been there." in relationship to all of these things, when in life, we, whoever we are, whatever we associate with, whatever we connect with, can keep the heartfulness of humour alive inside of us, so that we don't become such a danger in religious, spiritual experience, narrow, stuck, trapped, in the name, in fact, of teachings which have one single primary duty for human beings: to offer liberation. To offer liberation. The liberation of the human spirit from suffering, from fear, from confusion. One person in a small group today mentioned a common story. And I've been hearing from several friends in the 8 days that I've been here that there is a genuine and an understandable concern taking place of the number of cults that are growing within the society here, imported from elsewhere. And if I may say, a few months ago, last autumn, I was in Geneva, and you may have read of this terrible tragedy that took place, in which this cult committed both a murder and a suicide in two different areas, planned, organized, etc. As an example of the awful extremism that can arise with religious cults. And if I may say, I have spoken and written quite a lot on the dangers of the religious life and this identifying with and the cost that can take place in many, many ways in the name of liberation, in the name of finding truth, of realizing God. And while there, the Geneva Post interviewed me about this situation. And I said, one of the myths which takes place in the mind of the public, it's a very big one in fact, that cults consist of young people who are not very well educated, from poor backgrounds, who are emotionally vulnerable. Young, poor, not very well educated, and emotionally vulnerable. It's not that true, and it's very simplistic. The cross-section of the cult world, in fact, reaches right across the board, young and old alike. There are just as many PhDs in cults and middle-class affluent people involved in cults, East and West, as there are those who fall into that category. What is it that goes on in the human psyche, in the name of liberation, in the name of finding freedom and the liberating truth of life, that person's mind ends up stuck and trapped with the mentality of a goldfish in a small goldfish bowl? What's happened? And as I have said sometimes in the spiritual world, as one goes deep, never forget there are sharks in the deep. Never forget. So in that, when one is exposed to teachings and the contact with teachings, sometimes teachers in all the forms overexceed their authority. We have great authority, of course, but overexceed. And one of the ways that it's of overexceeding authority is telling people only this and nothing else. Stay with me, stay with us, only do this, and rejecting or dismissing or undermining or cutting people's right and opportunity to realize and appreciate spiritual life is a great exploration. We have, as teachers, the duty and the responsibility, in a way, to offer teachings. We don't have the right to say exclusivity, only this. We exceed our authority when we do that. So when I'm looking at ourselves, in terms of the theme here of the talk, religious experiences, a spiritual life, spiritual experiences, if we sometimes we look at ourselves and say, do you know, nothing has really touched me. Nothing has really reached me in that way. Then we do need to ask ourselves questions, why not? What am I doing in my day-to-day life that it's become so important, or so repetitive, or so mechanical, that I'm cut off from something deep and profound? Am I spending too much time in my head? Am I too much involved in knowledge and study? Am I too much involved in my personal relationship with somebody else? And am I just thinking about my career? Am I too much in the future, in the past? And so just as you and I have heard remarkable stories of sacrifice, in the deep sense of sacrifice from the past, believe me, the sacrifices which have to be made in the present are just as great as any sacrifices that were made in the past by the sages and the saints and the prophets that of 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 years ago. Realizing things of life and sacrificing for that. Sacrifice is still necessary. It's still just as vital. Can we be clear enough inside of ourselves? Our generations of teachers, whether of the Middle East or in the subcontinent of India or anywhere else, those that have realized are talking from their experience. What is ours? And therefore, belief in God, not sure about belief in God, not believing in God, I would say, is a distraction. It doesn't really matter. If you're comfortable with it, fine. If you're not comfortable with it, equally fine. If you have a religion, fine. If you don't have a religion, fine. Something matters more than just the concepts and the framework of tradition. What is it? Find that. What is it? So you and I in our days here together, we belong to that exploration. And there's a fine and noble history of human beings who have explored that. Right in this village. Right in this particular area. It's in the air and in the atmosphere here. Let's find that which fulfills everything. May all beings see into life. May all beings make sacrifices. May all beings discover that. So let's have a couple of quiet minutes together, shall we please?